Today's Taisho will be on Case 48 in the Momonkan. Case 48 is entitled Kenpo's One Road. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, "It is written, Bhagavats in the 10 directions, one straight road to Nirvana. I wonder where the road can be." Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line in the air and said, "Here it is." Later, the monks asked the same question of Umon, who held up his fan and said, "This fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indra. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, rain comes down in torrents." Mumon's comment, "One going to the bottom of the sea lifts up clouds of dust. The other, on top of the highest mountain, raises towering waves to wash the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go, each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle. But none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road." Mumon's verse, "Before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Even though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen tonight, this morning, sorry. I think we're all a little impatient for spring to get here. You know, one day it's 60 degrees and the next day it's 30 degrees. But the spring is going to take its own time, and that's probably a good thing. You know, I have been, like everybody else, I have been noticing the rise of mindfulness, You know, I'm, after I meditate in the morning, if I have time, if I don't have to rush right off to work, I have a cup of coffee and an apple or something. And I will read online the Huffington Post, and the Huffington Post usually has in the wellness section a bunch of articles on mindfulness. And the other day I was in Borders, I was in Barnes & Noble, rather. Borders doesn't exist anymore. I was in Barnes & Noble, and I was in their magazine stand, and I was browsing around, and I noticed that there's a magazine called Mindful. You know, mindfulness is everywhere. If you ask a book seller at Barnes & Noble, "Do you have any books on mindfulness?" that person will smile and take you over to the section that's all the books on mindfulness. And there are books not only on mindfulness, but like mindful eating, mindful driving, mindful parenting, if you Google mindful, you know, there'll be thousands and thousands of URLs. Mindfulness has really made it, and I was reading an article recently in Huffington Post about how mindfulness can help you on the job. That when you're, if you've worked 8 hours and you're tired, you can sit down and do some mindfulness meditation, and that will refocus your mind and allow you to do more work. Other people talk about mindfulness in similar ways as great strategy, like a tool in your toolkit for dealing with various kinds of challenges. And there is some support to this. People have done studies of mindfulness and outcomes of various kinds, and there does seem to be a positive outcome. you know, it's difficult to establish, but mindfulness meditation seems to be helpful. And so, you know, mindfulness is everywhere in our society, and yet, you know, I'm a little bit worried about the impact of mindfulness on our society, and I worry that it is making people misunderstand what Buddhism is all about and what meditation is all about. You know, I think it's a great shame. It will be a great shame if people wind up thinking of meditation as a tool in their toolbox. It's like a technique that you can use to pursue your goals. Now, that sounds like a crazy thing to say. What's wrong with pursuing your goals? And what's wrong with having another tool in your toolbox? So, you know, what concerns me about this is that that it's a shallow relationship to yourself, to meditation, and really to the world and to other people. You know, maybe you're in a high-pressure situation, and it's difficult sometimes because of the stress for you to focus your mind. And maybe you close the, if you happen to have an office, you close the door to your office and you sit down, you turn off the lights and you watch your breath and you focus mindfully on your breath. And then after a while, you can get up and cope better with your challenges. There's nothing wrong with that. But on the other hand, I worry that that understanding of meditation is shallow, you know. I'm not saying meditation shouldn't do good for you or help you with your work and so on and so on. But if that's all it does, I think we've really missed an opportunity to have a deeper relationship to meditation, to ourselves, and to everything else. You know, if meditation helps you to work an extra couple of hours, it's not so different from, say, having a bottle of Red Bull. Right? I mean, one comes in a bottle and one you get from just turning off the lights in your office and watching your breath. But in both cases, you know, you're using it as an instrument to accomplish a goal that you happen to have. And again, that sounds like what could be wrong with that? You know, it's actually quite a shallow goal. Quite a shallow use of meditation because, you know, maybe our goals are not always a good thing. Maybe our goals are not always a good thing. You know, people do have ideas about what will make them happy and what will be fulfilling to them. But I don't know if you've ever heard of a man named Daniel Gilbert. But Daniel Gilbert is a psychologist. And he has done lots of studies on human happiness. And he says that people are very poor predictors of what will make them happy. And he says that often, you know, when we imagine what we make will make us happy, we're really doing what we think other people want us to do. So when we think about what will make us happy, we're really listening in our minds to, you know, our mother or our father saying, you should do this, you know. And we really don't know ourselves what will make us happy. He actually is a scientist, a social scientist. So he has to make a scientific term. He calls this affective forecasting. In other words, you know, what's going to make you, are you going to be able to predict your emotional state at the end of doing something you want to do? And he has many, many studies that say, people say, when I do this, I will be happy. And then they do it and they're not happy. And I think that's really interesting. You know, I think his work is sort of revolutionary because, you know, people assume that happiness is something we can pursue as a goal. Gilbert says, you know, actually no. He wrote a book on the subject, and it's called Stumbling into Happiness. He said most people find out what will make them happy by accident while they're pursuing the thing they think will make them happy. See? Gilbert's own life is a good example of this. You know, he was a he went to college. He didn't like college. He dropped out of college and he got very interested in science fiction. And he fell in love with science fiction, and so he went to the local community college and he wanted to take a fiction writing class. And it was his only reason for going back to school. He went to the community college and he tried to sign up, but all the sections were full. And just out of sheer boredom, he signed up for a psychology class, you know. And he sat in on this class that he initially had no interest in, and it was absolutely gripping to him. And he eventually finished his associate's degree, went back to college, and now he's a professor at Harvard. So, you know, if you had asked him, what will make you happy, what will make you fulfilled in life, he would have said, I will be a great science fiction writer like Isaac Asimov or somebody like that. And that was surely his goal when he set his feet on the campus of that community college. But life took him in a very different direction, in a very different direction than the one he planned. And, you know, that process is really an interesting process. You know, he thought he was a certain kind of person, but he discovered that he wasn't. And he didn't know what kind of person he was, but he gradually discovered, you could say, who he was by pursuing these interests that he wasn't certain about. It's like, you know, he took a psychology course wanting to take a fiction writing course. And he found it engaging. And if you had asked him, maybe, why, what is so engaging about psychology, I doubt he could have said something intelligible. You know, probably he'd say, well, it interests me or something like that. What does that really mean? Well, I think that for Gilbert, taking that psychology class was like finding a door and opening it up into a series of rooms that he'd never visited before, and then walking through the rooms and being entranced by things he found. So, you know, it's a little bit as though part of Gilbert's mind was running ahead of his conscious mind. You know, his conscious mind said, become a science fiction writer. But there was another part of himself that needed something else, but he didn't know what. And when he went into that psychology class, it began to open up or activate that part of himself, which was, craving this kind of an experience. You know, he must have felt, in a way he probably didn't think about consciously, like he had discovered an undiscovered land, right? And that undiscovered land was partly the world, and it was partly himself. Psychology became his passion, and because it became his passion, he went all the way to graduate school, and he's been very successful, I think, because he loves what he does. It makes him feel more open. So this is sort of like the opposite of the toolkit model of life, right? You know, the toolkit model of life is that we formulate a goal and we pursue our goal with diligence and single-mindedness, right? And the things we do, the skills we develop should all be in the service of that goal. You know, but with Gilbert, you know, none of that held true. You know, he was pursuing something he didn't really fully even understand, but I suspect that it made him feel more open and alive. And if you had asked Gilbert at any stage in the process, do you know what you're doing, he probably would have said no. You know, it's pretty interesting that after going through this, getting a degree and going to graduate school, becoming a professor, he did all this research on happiness, and it kind of confirmed his own experience in a way, right? For the 18-year-old or the 22-year-old who wanted to be Isaac Asimov, you know, if you had said, what happens if you're going to wind up doing research with students in a classroom? He would have said, oh, that sounds terrible. But actually, that person didn't really understand himself very well. So, you know, the toolkit model is a really shallow way of thinking about life. And it's very much part of the mindfulness movement in the United States. The idea is you can pursue your goals more effectively if you have this toolkit that will allow you to sit down on the cushion, focus your mind, and do some extra hours of study or extra hours of... Question is, are you really awake when you're living that way? Is that really being fully awake or not? And this is a really interesting, this is a really important question. You know, when are you fully awake? When you're maximizing your potential and fulfilling your plans, or when you're more open to the way things, to the possibilities of existence, you know, possibilities you might not even be able to glimpse. I have to say that you know, I'm an English professor, so I have a big I have a prejudice, I must admit, in favor of the unknowable. And I'm also a Zen teacher, so I have an even bigger preference and bias, you could say, in favor of the unknowable. But there's something about the unknowable which is liberating in a way the knowable isn't so. It isn't, you know. There are some things that can be made into tools, like my watch. You know, I have to watch out when people come into my office because they'll be talking to me and suddenly they'll see my eyes dart down to my watch. And, you know, I've had people actually apologize, and I said, no, what you're saying is really interesting. I just need to, I have a meeting in 20 minutes or something. I have to go off to it. And I'm always looking at my watch because I have a kind of a tightly scheduled life. And my watch is a tool that helps me get to different places. But there's things my watch can't do for me. You know, when I sit down on the cushion, I have a very different relationship to time. You know, time sort of disappears or it telescopes out. And sometimes I feel I'm in a timeless place. But, you know, if I lived exclusively by my watch, I would never discover those other possibilities. You know, so a watch is a tool. That's definitely true. Some things aren't tools in the same way. Like, you know, poetry. I actually love poetry. And, you know, so far, very few people have been able to make money off of poetry, though they've tried. And I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, if you say, what's the purpose of poetry? You know, in a certain sense, poetry is absolutely useless. And actually, that's what makes it so liberating. It's not a tool. It's not a tool. Nobody's successfully made poetry into a tool. You know, sometimes English teachers in elementary school try to make poetry into a tool. So they'll make people read a Walt Whitman poem, and kids never really read it. You know, they can't understand it. They don't like it. And sometimes people have to read Shakespeare and take quizzes on the characters in Shakespeare. But, you know, generally speaking, You know, poetry is perfectly useless. And it's not even effective communication. You know, if you want to make a point, you can make a point much more effectively by writing it out in prose. When you read a poem, it's really not about communicating a particular message. It's about opening something up in yourself that you didn't know, you know. It's about showing you the world in a different way. So it's kind of like the opposite of a tool, see? You know, to use a tool, you already have a purpose in mind, right? Like I have, my wife is a gardener, and I am the laborer for the gardener. So when my wife wants to do work in the garden, I come out and just say, please dig a hole here, and I'll dig the hole. So I dig the hole with a shovel. I have three different kinds of shovels. I have a wheelbarrow, and I have rake and a hoe, you know, all my tools. So, you know, I use my shovel to dig holes. I use my rake to rake the stones off the dirt, you know, and so on. There's no uncertainty. It doesn't really open up anything new to me. You know, having that relationship to my tools doesn't change anything in my world. You know, but sometimes, I'll be outside, and I'll turn and I'll just see like the trees in bloom. And it's so beautiful, right? It's a totally different experience and totally unexpected. You know, I didn't expect to have this experience. It's totally uncalled for. And when I have it, I feel like I'm lifted out of myself a little bit. Things change a little bit. And I think that's why people read poetry. You know, poetry is really not like a tool. Poetry is the opposite of a tool. It's taking you to a place that you don't know yet. And it's opening a bunch of doors in yourself. Now, you know, I think meditation is really all about that. And I think turning meditation into a tool for living, a tool for efficiency or something like that, is really destructive to meditation. And I realize it helps in the short term. Helps in the short term. But in the long term, it doesn't help anybody because it's not making their world bigger. It's just allowing them to function in the same old world a little more efficiently. This is a sort of an odd thing to say. Years ago, a woman came here on introductory night on a Monday night, and she wanted to practice meditation. I asked her, after the sit, we talked, and I said, so why are you learning to study meditation? And she had she said, you know, I just opened a store, I just opened a business near here, and I'm under a lot of pressure. And she said, so I wanted to do meditation to help me cope with the pressure. And I said, that's great. You know, meditation will definitely help you deal with the pressure. And so she began to come every week. And she was serious about this. And she was getting pretty good. And she did report to me. She said, yes, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, the pressure is much less now. And I'm really able to cope. So I think she came for about 6 months, and then, you know, if you're a Zen teacher, you have to, you sometimes have to take a risk that doesn't work out. But I said to her, you know, what your practice right now is pretty good. But, if you were really practicing, it wouldn't matter to you whether your store succeeded or failed. And she never came back. See? And, you know, I can't really blame her. I mean, I think she was practicing meditation kind of like as a magical talisman, right? If I just do this, my business won't fail. And when I said, you know, what if your business does fail? What then? That was unthinkable. And I had sort of like broken the spell. But, you know, actually, if you read the literature on small businesses, more small businesses fail than succeed. You know, my brother was a businessman until he died, and he had a pretty successful small business. But he had incredible stressful experiences. One time he was mowing his lawn, and his accountant drove up in his car. It was a summer day. And this was during we had a big recession. This was many years ago, but an economic downturn. And my brother's accountant got out of his car and walked up to my brother and said, "Peter, we need to talk." He said, "Your business lost $20,000 last year." And my brother said his legs gave out from under him, literally. You know, that was, and so I know what small business people go through. But, you know, when I said to her, you know, when you practice, it should no longer matter to you whether your business succeeds or fails, I was trying to do her a favor. You know, in other words, you know, if your business fails, it's not the end of the world. You know, it seems right now that when your business fails, it's going to be the end of the world. But it's not the end of the world. And, you know, this is something we discover on the cushion. You know, if you've had experience, you know, I've had many disappointments in my life. You know, when I was in graduate school, for a couple of years, I couldn't get a job anywhere. And I remember, having my heart set on this job. It was a university in California called Pomona College. And when I read the job description, it was like, oh, that's me. There's my job, right? And I just thought, you know, this is going to work out. I'm going to get this job at Pomona College. You know, I'm exactly what they're looking for. And I remember going to the job interview in the room where the interview was taking place. I was coming in as one of the candidates was going out. And I recognized the woman who was the candidate coming out because she was a famous scholar. And she had her book in her hand. And I thought, I'm toast, right? And indeed, I was toast, right? You know. So, you know, I didn't get the job at Pomona College. You know, and I remember, you know, even though I had been doing Zen practice, you know, I came home thinking, oh, I'm toast, you know. My life is over. You know, I had that feeling, that emotional feeling, like my life, it's the end of the world, right? But you know, that's the model of I'm at point A and I'm going to point B and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure I get there. And I don't want to think about not getting to point B. It was hard for that woman to contemplate her business not succeeding. But actually, most small businesses fail. So you know, at some point, you know, a deeper practice of meditation wouldn't have been saying, how can I succeed? A deeper practice of meditation would be, how can I be open to life as it is unfolding? See? I came back from those job interviews really crushed. And I thought, well, that's the only job I can think of that I really want to do. And, you know, meanwhile, I was teaching writing to students, and a job opened up at Rutgers. And I didn't think Rutgers would give me a job, because Rutgers has a very good reputation, and I didn't think I was that good. I went to the job interview thinking there's no way I'm going to get this job, so I was very relaxed. You know, I just thought, well, you know, this will be a good experience for me. And we talked, we even laughed. It was like, I just thought, you know, this is not going to work out. And then I got a call and they said, we'd like to give you the job. I was like, what? That can't be, that really? Are you sure you have the right guy? You know, it was, I'm not kidding, it was like that. I think the secret was they must have thought, this guy's really good, he's so calm. right? He just, you know. And they were actually like eager to get me. It was like, huh? But you know, I think that mentality is so liberating, right? As long as you're saying, if I don't get to point B, my life is over. It's over. That creates incredible tunnel vision, right? Incredible tunnel vision. You know, you won't even permit yourself if you're that fright. You know, fear is it kills intelligence. I don't know if you've noticed that, but the fear is the enemy of intelligence. When people are afraid, they can't think. It's like the deer in the headlights. You dare not think because who knows what you're going to think. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath, you know, you begin to loosen up. You begin to get, let go of your thoughts. You open, a very famous Japanese teacher called it opening the hand of thought. His name was Kosho Uchiyama. He wrote a book called Opening the Hand of Thought. It's like your hand is tightly clenched. And you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath. And after a while, you know, ideas just come and go. They're not so threatening. Right? Not so threatening. This is a different way to live, to be open to the possibilities. Possibilities. One way to think about meditation is that we don't maybe naturally and instinctively have that openness. You know, some people do. There are people who just... they just seem to be serenely open to the possibilities, right? But, you know, a lot of us aren't like that. You know, we're fairly fearful, tense people. And, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and meditate, you know, it very rarely goes the way you planned. You know, meditation rarely happens the way you planned. Isn't that interesting, by the way? See, I mean, you come in to sit down. You drove here this morning. Maybe you said, okay, it's Saturday, I'm going to get out of bed, I'm going to come in, because the last time I did this, I had a fantastic sit. And so you got out of bed, you had a cup of coffee, you drove here, you sat down on the cushion, you thought, okay, this is going to be great. And then, you know, your legs hurt, you're distracted, and, you know, it takes forever for half an hour to go by. You know, it's like, what happened? You know, meditation is so uncontrollable. You know, if you notice, usually there's like a rhythm to your practice. So you might go for a while where your practice is just very unfocused, and then all of a sudden it's like you're on a roll. And it's like every sit is fantastic. And you might have a sit where you think, oh, now I remember why I got into this. You know, this is so great. And then, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you say, here we go, you know, but it doesn't happen. It's uncontrollable. You know, part of the reason it's uncontrollable is because it's coming from a deeper place in yourself. You know, it's coming from what we in Zen call your big mind. There's your little mind, which is the mind that says, I want to be like Isaac Asimov, see? And I'm going to take this fiction writing course, and the professor is going to say, oh, you have a lot of talent. You might be the next Isaac Asimov. But then, you know, the course is closed. And now you're drifting aimlessly. And you take this other course, this stupid psychology course, you know, psychology. And then, you know, all of a sudden you realize, geez, I feel alive. I feel so excited, you know. Where is that coming from? So you didn't really know yourself. You know, that's a deeper relationship. That's now you're unconscious. Your big mind is speaking, as we say in Zen. Your big mind is activated. You know, and if somebody said to you, you know, if somebody said to Gilbert, why do you like psychology? He said, I don't know. I just like it. And that's not a stupid answer. See, that's actually a very intelligent answer. You know, because, you know, that means he's more attuned to his deeper mind, his big mind. You know, when you can give an answer, that's often pretty shallow. Well, I'm maximizing my job options, right? You know, that's kind of shallow. But you say, I don't know. I feel, he probably couldn't have said, I feel more alive when I'm doing psychology, but that's probably what he meant. See? It's like, you know, poetry. You know, poetry is utterly useless. And that's what makes it so wonderful. You know, when you read a poem, the first reading, you have no idea sometimes what the hell is this person talking about? And you could say, why doesn't he just write it out? But see, it's an adventure. And as you read the poem two or three times, you start connecting things that are normally disconnected. And it's very much like activating your unconscious mind. You know? And then suddenly, halfway through the poem, you find tears running down your face, right? Or you feel a thrill of adventure, right? It's a different way of living. It's not the tool for living approach. It's the 100% open living approach, right? So meditation has a tool-like quality. I too enjoy the fact that if I've graded papers all day and I meditate, I might be totally exhausted. But I meditate for an hour and suddenly I can grade papers for another 2 hours. That's not why I do Zen, however. And I think if that's all meditation is to people, in a generation it will disappear. You know, the real question is, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? Those are the real questions. And the answers, we can't answer that question with our conscious minds. Those only speak what we already know. Those questions can only be answered by the big mind, and answering them is a process of discovery. See? So meditation is a process of discovery. It's like reading a poem. You just don't know where it's taking you. You just have to trust the process. And meditation is the same way. You know, a monk said to Kenpo Osho, it is written, there are Bhagavats, or you could say holy ones, in the 10 directions, Indian thinking about space was a little different from Western thinking. In the West, there are four cardinal directions, right? North, east, south, and west, and then you can subdivide those to get eight. And in Indian thinking, there's also 10 because there's up and down. See, so there's another dimension of space. So. It is written, there are holy ones in the 10 directions, but one straight road to nirvana. I still wonder where the road can be. See, so, you know, the right road, right? What's the right road? What road should we be on? See? And Kenpo takes his staff and he draws a line in the air and he says, there it is. See? So, any road you pick is going to be okay if you are activating your big mind. And any road you pick, if you're making the decision out of fear, is going to be a bad choice. You know, generally speaking in life, when we make decisions out of fear, we all do it, we usually make a terrible decision. It's something to watch in yourself. Whenever you're making life choices from a place of fear or anxiety, usually bad choice. Usually like a choice you will regret. You know, you have to answer the question, who are we, where are we going, and where do we come from? Where do we come from and where are we going, I should say. You know, we have to understand ourselves, and we don't understand ourselves. That's why we have to meditate. Who are we really? See? You know, early Buddhists, it's interesting, in the history of Buddhism, you know, early Buddhists didn't see things this way. You know, right after the Buddha had his great awakening, he started teaching, and he taught for the next 40 years, almost 50 years, 48 years, I think, 46, 48 years. But anyway, he died, and then you know, some of his students had had a great awakening experience also. But you know, they had to try to make sense of what the Buddha had told them, and so you know, they tried to interpret what the Buddha said to the best of their abilities. And early Buddhists said, there are different states of mind. And they can be, we can map them out. And there's this state of mind, this state of mind, this state of mind, this state of mind, this state of mind. And they made like a little map. At the top was enlightenment. And all these other states of mind were under it. And you could say this state of mind is, you know, five steps from the top. This state of mind is four steps from the top. They worked out an elaborate scheme or a state of progress called, stages were called jhanas, J-H-A-N-A-S, jhana. And they said the first jhana is when you go into a room and you close the door and it's quiet and you enjoy quiet calmness. That's the first jhana. And the second jhana is when you're sitting on the cushion and your thoughts begin to disappear. That's the second jhana. And the third jhana is when you start to enter, you start to enter empty mind. And then the fourth jhana, you know. And then there's those are the jhanas of the preliminary jhanas, and then there's advanced jhanas. They're called the formless jhanas. And if you read this stuff, you realize I've been in that jhana. But you know, when you meditate, it isn't like that. You don't go step by step. One minute you're in emptiness, the next minute you're thinking about getting dog food on the way home. You know, the next minute you're having a fantasy, right? You know, the next minute you're remembering music, and then you're back into emptiness again. It's not a sequence like that, right? But it's also false in another way, because you know these early Buddhists said there is a state of mind called enlightenment, and you go through these different stages and you get to it, and that is enlightenment, and no other state of mind is enlightenment. And that's how early Buddhists understood the Buddha's teaching. But what that means is that, you know, when the Buddha was eating his dinner, he wasn't enlightened. If you get my point, he was in ordinary consciousness. He was going, any more rice in the bowl? And at that moment, instead of being focused on enlightened mind, he was just wondering if there's any more dal and rice left. See, there's lots of problems with the early Buddhist understanding of enlightenment as a single state. And later Buddhists said, no, it's not like that. You can be enlightened while you're eating your dinner. You can be enlightened while you're going to the bathroom. There's a famous koan, what is Buddha? Buddha is a toilet paper. So, you know, while you're wiping your ass, you can be an enlightened mind. Now, how is this possible? Well, it's no particular state of mind is actually enlightened mind. Enlightened mind is present in all states of mind if you don't hold on. If you don't hold on. You know, the problem is when we cling to any particular state of consciousness, we become the prisoner of that state of consciousness. It becomes our jail. What we're doing is treating that state of consciousness as something we can control or occupy. You know, it's the toolkit mentality again. You know, early Buddhists thought of all of this as a toolkit. You know, basically, you've got a toolkit full of different states of consciousness, and there's one called enlightenment. And later Buddhists said, no, that's fundamentally mistaken. All states of awareness could be enlightened if you don't hold on to them. In Zen, we call this the nowhere dwelling mind. The nowhere dwelling mind, or mind not resting on anything. See, not resting on anything. This mind, if you had come this morning early and you read the Shinshin Ming, Seng Tsan says, you know, basically this is a consciousness that doesn't cling to anything. It is at home everywhere because it clings nowhere. See. And if you can be in that state of mind, your mind becomes gradually awake wherever you're doing. Cooking dinner, doing calligraphy, going to the bathroom. You know, in Zen stories are full of stories of people having enlightenment experiences while they're out pulling weeds in the garden. You know, in early Buddhism, monks and nuns weren't allowed to work. Isn't that interesting? You were absolutely not supposed to work. And in fact, you know, even today in Theravada communities, those monks are not supposed to cook for themselves. Somebody is supposed to come from the community and make your meals for you. And they're like prohibited. But when Zen went to China, totally different thing. Great Zen master basically said, you know, that assumes that you can't be an enlightened mind when you're working. But, you know, you could be pulling up weeds and your mind could be deeply awake. See, no single state of mind is the awakened state. All states of mind are awakened if you don't cling to them. See, there's Bhagavats, holy ones in the 10 directions, but any direction you choose is going to work out if you don't hold on. So if you have the nowhere dwelling mind, see. And Zen is full of these stories of people out in the field, and the student sees a wild duck fly by and says, that was a wild duck flying by. And the teacher says, is he gone? And the student says, I don't know. And the teacher squeezes his nose, and the student has an awakening experience. How's that possible if enlightenment is just one state? So you know, yes, meditation can be a tool for living. But a better way to practice Zen is as a way of being fully at home wherever you are and whatever you're doing. You know, if you practice Zen as a way of discovery, opening your world up, it will always be alive. You know, I've been doing this for 40 years. Every time I sit down on the cushion, what would be my motive in saying this if it weren't true? You know, I love doing meditation, and every time I sit down on the cushion, it's a new world for me, and I love it. You know, how is that possible? How's that possible? But it's easy if you learn how to be present without holding on. And then every moment becomes this new experience. All becomes a journey of discovery. A monk said to Kenpo Osho, Osho means priest, it is written, holy ones in the 10 directions, but one straight road to nirvana. I wonder where the road can be. Kenpo lifted his staff, drew a line, and said, here it is. Later, the monks asked the same question to Umon, whose name means cloud gate. And he doesn't answer the same way. He takes his fan, and he says, this fan jumps up to the 33rd heaven and hits the nose of the deity Sakra Devanam Indram. When you strike the carp of the eastern sea, rain comes down in torrents. In other words, you know, I live for the unexpected. I live with the discovery at the center of my life. Discovery. Mumon's comment, one going to the bottom of the sea lifts clouds of dust, the other on top of the highest mountain raises towering waves to the sky. One holding fast, the other letting go. Each stretches out his hand to support the profound teaching. No one state of mind is enlightened. They are just like two riders starting from opposite ends of the course and meeting in the middle, but none on earth can be absolutely direct. When examined with a true eye, neither of these two great masters knows the road, because every road is the road. Mumon's verse, before a step is taken, the goal is reached. Before the tongue is moved, the speech is finished. Though each move is ahead of the next, there is still a transcendent secret.